Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Napier is waking up to a second day in a state of emergency as it comes to terms with one of its worst floods. Hundreds of properties have been damaged, at least 16 homes are uninhabitable, 12 significantly damaged, and about 30 people have been forced to shelter at an evacuation centre. Two more homes were evacuated in Marewa overnight, where the water is still knee-deep. Residents in some low-lying suburbs remain trapped in their homes, and several cars are stranded in the middle of roads that are still lakes. Harry Locke's been speaking to some of those hit hard by the devastation.
The Wepa family decided to leave their house at 8 o'clock on Monday evening. The rain was pouring and the water was rising, nearly at the front door. Mother and grandmother Christine Wepa says it came to a point when the seven adults and two babies had no choice but to get out.
We rushed around, stressed, trying to get everything, put everything in rubbish bags, chucked in the truck. The rain was drenched, the spouting on our thing was just waterfalls. Trying to get our stuff into the truck and get our family into the truck was awful. The water was right up. We literally were waist deep.
They fled to a relative's place. 18 people crammed into a three-bedroom house in Flaxmere. Yesterday they moved into the evacuation centre at Kennedy Park, where they spent last night.
It's emotional because we're not vulnerable people. We don't rely on, you know, we're strong, we do things, we're independent, and to be so, yeah.
What's even more worrying is that many of her neighbours and people in her community don't know help is available or how to get it. She's fearful of what lies ahead.
We got no insurance, so we're worried about our home being ripped off, people knowing that we're not there. We're just, like, you know, sitting here. We can't really drive to our home because the truck's halfway underwater.
The Wepa family are among the dozens who have spent the night at the evacuation centre. But families who chose to stay at their homes in the hardest hit areas are effectively trapped, unable to leave without wading through water, which at points remains waist high. Daigo Ngātai lives with her son in Marewa, a suburb in Napier South. The water hasn't reached inside her home, but it isn't shifting in the street outside.
We're going to buckle down and watch movies and munch out and try and block out the rain, because the rain's pretty heavy and the raindrops, have you noticed, are huge.
The deluge on Monday night also led to the dramatic rescue of a woman who was caught in a river of mud. Chris Brady lives on Main Street in Hospital Hill, the area where authorities are most worried about slips. He and a friend rushed to help a woman buried up to her chest in a torrent of mud that had swept through the backyard of a nearby house.
She was jumped down by those bags. I think she might have dragged those bags with her or not. Whether she just got blown out into that and Paul come up behind. I jumped out over to here, but it was a torrent of water, and then Paul collected her from where that shed was.
He says it could have turned out a lot worse.
The lady was obviously in shock when we got her out. There was a couple of young kids in there and with their parents and another tenant, actually. Yeah, so it was a fairly full house and they were all bloody lucky.
And while some people narrowly avoided tragedy, for others the deluge simply meant it was time to take advantage of all that water.
I figured, oh, we'll go to the warehouse, buy inflatable, have some fun, you know, why not? It's not all about disaster, you can come out here and have some fun while you're doing it, so yeah.
Jacob Satherley says you need to take the opportunity when it presents itself.
It's only meant to be a little creek, but this is a big bloody flood here, so yeah, we're just out here having a bit of fun.
Meanwhile, the council is now trying to sort out long-term accommodation for those who won't be able to return to their homes. More rain is forecast today, and the heavy rain watch remains in place until 8 o'clock this evening. From Napier, for Morning Report, Harry Locke.
We can speak now to Napier Mayor Kirsten Wise. Good morning.
How are you?
Very well. Okay, tell us the situation. First, I think with the evacuees overnight, two families did have to be evacuated, more families being checked on. What's the latest there?
So yes, the priority area at the moment is the low-lying area in Marewa, where there's still some flood water, and that was where some families were evacuated last night, and that will be where we're heading back to this morning as well. In addition to that, we actually have got some pumps. We have had to bring in some pumps overnight, which will enable us to get into that area and start doing some additional work to pump the water out of there.
Are you aware of any families who are still there?
Are families that are still there. There are families that don't wish to leave. So it's about going and meeting with as many of them or all of them that are still there and having a conversation with them and ensuring that we're meeting their needs.
And you want them to go, though?
Well, we have ascertained that they're not at any immediate health risk. We haven't made any calls about forcing them to leave, but certainly any of the families that do want to leave, we're there to assist them and evacuate them out.
But in terms of access to that suburb, it's difficult with the roads and that water not draining away.
So, yes, we have been using Unimogs. The streets are closed. It's actually three streets predominantly that are affected. So currently at the moment there isn't just normal vehicle access, no.
The slips in the hill suburbs, what is the latest there? Have you got any more concerns? We know what, 14 to 16 houses that are in trouble?
At this stage there's been no reports of any additional slips or any additional damage. We have obviously had some more rain overnight, but the team have been out this morning to look through the hill and obviously go around our whole water network as well. And at the moment, everything is operating as it should be and we have no major concerns.
What is your wider message to the people of Napier this morning in terms of going to work, going to schools? What are you telling them?
I do know that some schools have chosen to remain closed, so parents, please check in with your children's schools. We are still encouraging people to work from home if they can. And I think it's all about, you know, just ensuring that you keep yourselves and your family safe and that you're aware of help that's out there.
Are you seeking further assistance from central government with this clean-up?
Well, I'm actually just about to go and meet with the Minister of Emergency Management now and our local MPs, so we'll certainly be having a conversation about what's the next steps over the next couple of days.
And you think this will take some time, though?
Certainly the families and the properties that have been the most affected, we will have to be looking at finding some longer term accommodation options for them. So that will be an absolute priority.
What has gone wrong here? Why was there such bad flooding? Did the storm system simply not up to scratch?
Not at all. It was simply the severity of the downpour. I've certainly never experienced anything like it in my life. And for the sustained period of time that it went on for. And we have confirmed it was a 1 in 250 year event. Our system and infrastructure is designed to cope with a 1 in 100 year event.
The reality is, though, that we're looking at a world where climate change is accelerating extreme weather events. And we may start to see more of these types of events in future.
That's exactly right. And you may or may not be aware, but there is actually throughout the country at the moment a national reform and review being undertaken of our three waters. So that's, of course, wastewater, stormwater and drinking water. And part of the drive behind that is recognising that we may have to invest further in our infrastructure to cope with these weather events we now
experience. So how does Napier's system work? Currently, is the stormwater and the wastewater combined?
No, they're not combined. What happens when we do have any of these heavy rain events is that, unfortunately, we do at that time have to open some valves, which means that at that point in time the wastewater is released into the stormwater system.
So in future, though, you're signalling infrastructure investment to enable you not to have to do that if you get another big flood?
We are here at Napier City Council last year made water our number one priority, and as such we've got a huge amount of investment planned in our water infrastructure over the next few years, and we actually have decided that, and this was decided last year as well, that some of those projects are actually being fast-tracked.
And have you got the money to be able to do that? A number of councils don't have the borrowing ability. Can you borrow to do that infrastructure work?
We absolutely can. We currently have no external debt, so we're in a very sound financial position.
Kirsten Wise, really appreciate your time this morning. Napier Mayor. To politics now, Judith Collins has held on to the National Party leadership and has a new wingman, Dr. Shane Reti. All eyes are now turning to who will get what in Collins' shadow cabinet, which will be announced at 1:30 today. The finance portfolio looks certain to be up for grabs, and with so few MPs, there are plenty of jobs to go round. Here's political reporter Jo Moore.
In the lead-up to the election, on the back of one implosion after another, it was the old guard, Judith Collins and Gerry Brownlee, who stepped up to lead the party. After a disastrous showing, including as campaign chair, Mr. Brownlee has thrown in the towel, and yesterday the little-known, until recently, Shane Reti, took over as deputy. The caucus unanimously backed him.
The caucus has seen me as a safe pair of hands, as a trusted pair of hands and a hard-working pair of hands. All attributes that Gerry has, of course, as well. But caucus have asked me to step forward into this role today.
With just 33 MPs, compared with the 56 the National Party won at the last election, Judith Collins will be on the hunt for a few more pairs of safe hands. Picking a shadow cabinet and assigning portfolios is no easy task, made more difficult by having a shell of a caucus remaining.
And everyone will have their role to play, and some of them would like to see it slightly differently and all that, but the best way to get forward is just to focus on what we need to do.
Some MPs will get rewarded with a promotion, like former Chief Whip Barbara Couriger, one of the few to hold on to her seat in the red tidal wave.
Barbara Couriger specifically told me that she had had, now I think about 3 years in the job. She's been outstanding in that, and she really, really wanted some portfolios to get her teeth into, and so she's getting exactly that.
Others could be at risk of a fall as Ms. Collins tries to heal wounds in the caucus after a string of leaders and deputies. But Nicola Willis, who was promoted after Todd Muller's coup over Simon Bridges, claims the entire caucus is responsible for mistakes of the past.
I think you find the caucus elected Todd Muller as leader. I was a member of the caucus, and caucus takes responsibility for leadership decisions.
Some MPs were happy to share their aspirations. Mark Mitchell, another MP who managed to hold on to his seat, reckons he's ready to join the economic team.
I've been happy to pass on defence to someone else because I've had that for 4 years. But I've asked for an economic portfolio, and I also have Sport and Rec, and I've requested that I hang on to Sport and Rec.
He might not be disappointed either, with Ms. Collins hinting he's in line for a reward.
He's got some really good stuff coming for him in terms of portfolios, and I really want to value his work.
To try and fill the gaps, Judith Collins could end up in a position where new MPs will be given jobs that in any other parliamentary term would be considered above their pay grades. Former Air New Zealand Chief Executive turned Botany MP Chris Luxon could be one of those, along with Samoan MP Nicola Grigg, who formerly worked for Bill English. But Judith Collins is keeping tight-lipped on portfolios other than the obvious.
Dr. Shane and I are working through some of those, but in particular I can say that he will take the health portfolio.
Today's announcement will be no minor reshuffle as Ms. Collins tries to pitch her best attack dogs against Jacinda Ardern's strongest ministers.
I think people will be quite surprised by some of the changes.
After 3 years of criticising Labour for its dearth of talent, Ms. Collins now needs to spread her own much smaller pool as widely as possible. From Parliament for Morning Report, Jo Moyer.
The government's top legal adviser is accused of breaching guidelines by giving two men immunity from prosecution for rape and murder. The men's evidence led to the conviction of Gail Maney for the murder of West Auckland tire fitter Dean Fuller-Sands. The Solicitor General has now come under fire from AUT law professor Chris Gledhill, who says the case needs to go to retrial or to the newly created Criminal Cases Review Commission. Maney has spent the last 2 weeks back in prison, the fourth time she's been recalled for breaching her parole conditions. Investigative journalist Guyon Espiner has the story.
Gail Maney is on life parole. One of her conditions is no drugs or alcohol ever. That's something that Tim McKinnell, an investigator working to prove Maney's innocence, says she's struggled with.
just over a week ago, she met with her parole officer. In the course of that meeting, she made an admission that she had used illegal drugs, and as a result of that admission, they recalled her back to prison.
The parole board released her from prison at a hearing yesterday. But if she breaches her conditions again, she'll be back behind bars. Maney was convicted in 1999 for ordering Stephen Stone to do a hit and murder Dean Fullersands in retaliation for a petty theft. But two men who say they actually fired gunshots into his body walked free. Neil and Martin have permanent name suppression but were given these names in the joint RNZ Stuff podcast on the case called Gone Fishing. As well as shooting Dean Fullersands, Neil and Martin also say they raped Leah Stevens and disposed of her body. The Crown case was that Leah Stevens was murdered by Stephen Stone to stop her speaking out about the murder of Dean Fullersands. Professor Chris Gledhill said the Solicitor General appears to have breached Crown guidelines in granting Neil and Martin immunity from prosecution in 1998.
It has to be somebody who's a minor accomplice in the scenario, and somebody who's not a minor accomplice because they've participated in more criminality than was alleged against Miss Maney, that seemed like a disproportionate grant of immunity in that situation.
Professor Gledhill said the Solicitor General was not supposed to give immunity from prosecution to someone who could be considered a greater risk to public safety than the person they were giving evidence against.
Now, obviously, on the Crown version of events, somebody who's ordered a hit is a risk, but somebody who's participated in two murders and a rape, I'd have thought is more of a risk to public safety, and yet the grant of immunity was in relation to all those matters.
Professor Gledhill says guidelines about inducements being offered to witnesses may also have been breached. At a retrial in 2000, Neil said he asked for $30,000 to come back to New Zealand and give evidence against Maney and Stone, and that the police had mentioned he would get compensation for lost wages.
The guidelines make it clear that there can't be any inducement other than the grant of an immunity. And here there's at least a suggestion of that from the mouth of one of the people granted immunity. That again is something which at the very least has to be investigated properly.
Another of the Crown Law guidelines is that evidence given by people offering immunity from prosecution must be credible. But Tim McKinnell says Neil and Martin repeatedly lied to police about major details, including changing the location of murder scenes and even inventing a fictitious murder.
When you go back and look at the evidence, you see that they invented a murder, they invented crime scenes. That they're not just small discrepancies in their evidence, they're saying completely different things happened.
The lead detective in the case, Mark Franklin, said in the podcast Gone Fishing that he stood by the police work and the convictions had stood up in front of two juries and the Court of Appeal. He also said he was gutted that Neil and Martin had walked free.
My number one priority was to identify and prosecute the principal offender. If that meant some of the peripheral offenders having to go by, well, so be it. I've never had a case where an offender has confessed to murder and rape and been given immunity. But that's not my decision, that's the Solicitor General's.
Crown Law would not answer questions on the case, refusing an Official Information Act request from RNZ and saying it was a matter of legal privilege. Mo te hotaka o te ata, ko Guy and Espina, tēnei.
A leading health official says the distribution of any COVID-19 vaccine will be a complex process, and he hopes it will be explained clearly to the public. Pharmaceutical companies Pfizer and BioNTech are making strides in the development of a vaccine and, if successful, will sell enough doses for 750,000 New Zealanders. The question then is, who will be at the front of the queue? College of GPs Medical Director Dr. Brian Betty says that decision will be tricky, as will the process of importing the vaccine to New Zealand. He joins us now. Good morning, Dr. Betty.
Good morning, Corin.
Okay, a tricky process. How should New Zealand go about it in terms of consulting the public and getting that right?
Look, I think the government is going to work and the ministry are going to have to work very hard on this. I mean, there are a couple of issues with the vaccine. In particular, it has to be transported at minus 80 degrees Celsius. Now, this is very, very different from the normal vaccines that we use, such as flu vaccines and other vaccines that we have routinely. So how this is brought into the country at that temperature and how it is distributed around the country, and then where it's actually given, whether that'll be at central depot points or how that's actually done, needs to be thought through really, really carefully. And the government is going to have to put together, obviously, an expert group to look at this.
So your average GP, would they have the facilities to be able to accommodate that?
Oh, look, at this point, no. And, you know, at the moment, I mean, general practice or general practices generally have fridges which keeps vaccines at a particular temperature. That's a very established system that's there. But again, this one sits way outside of that normal routine way of distribution. So there's going to have to be a whole new distribution sort of network put into place. And the second part that goes with that, it'll have to be worked out very, very clearly as to who will need to get vaccinated in the first instance, because there's only going to be 750,000 people who could be vaccinated in the first instance in order to give maximum protection to the people of New Zealand.
What would be your thinking on that? Obviously vulnerable people with underlying health conditions, perhaps those working on the borders, on the front line in hospitals, would they be the top of the queue?
Sure. So, look, I mean, when you look at the situation, obviously those that have been differentially affected with COVID have been the elderly. We know that from the experience over the last 9 months, and those patients living with comorbidities such as diabetes and chest conditions. And that could differentially as well impact on Māori and Pacific. So, yeah, vulnerable populations need to be thought of very, very hard. However, the experience of the last few months has shown us that the border is the place where COVID actually breaches or comes through into New Zealand. So, obviously, the border starts to become a high priority in terms of protection and an additional layer of protection with the use of a vaccine. So when you start to think about that, you start to think about where the vaccine could be placed and where the priority needs to be placed. So obviously, yeah, the border, I think, is very, very important. Obviously, healthcare workers who interact with COVID patients or potentially could interact with COVID patients become a very important point. And those elderly and vulnerable communities also become real focuses.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, in terms of the time frame. So if we're thinking that it's possible that if all going well, we could be looking at getting some doses by next year, but we'd be hoping, wouldn't we, that other vaccines come on stream as well, when it was not just the one horse we've got in the race, so to speak. So we'd be hoping there'll be others.
Look, I mean, it's been an extraordinary experience. I mean, a vaccine from start to finish normally takes 2 years plus to develop. The fact this is close, and it's not quite there yet, they're still finishing their what we call phase three trials and their safety data and collecting all that. To do this in 9 months is absolutely extraordinary. But what we know is the Pfizer vaccine that we have at the moment is one of many, many vaccines that are in development across the world. So you're right. This is probably not going to be the only vaccine that starts to tip over into an ability to be used in the general public. And so there's likely to be other vaccines that start to come on stream over time. So it's a very fluid situation at the moment in terms of what's happening. I'd say it's very, very positive that this is actually happening at this point, but the reality is it's not going to be a vaccine that suddenly appears and the whole of New Zealand is vaccinated. This will be a slow, very careful, deliberate process that actually occurs here.
This is a different vaccine. It's a RNA. It uses a different mechanism. There's always some in the community who are wary of vaccination. How important will a good education campaign be to roll out with this?
I think communication is going to be absolutely critical. I think communication between the government, the ministry, the DHBs, frontline general practice and to the population of New Zealand and patients is going to be absolutely critical. I mean, the vaccine has gone through the normal processes. So this is to a phase three trial. In order for vaccines to get accredited, they need to be tested on 30,000 plus people. So these are very, very large randomized trials. And that's what's occurring at this point. Assuming that it gets to that point, and as I said, this work has been finished off with this particular vaccine, but there's a lot of hope that it's going to get across the line. It then has to come through the New Zealand regulatory processes. That is, MedSafe has to look in detail at all the data, all the safety data, how it's used, what it does, and only then would it be put into the New Zealand itself. Now, with that, you're absolutely right. The communication is going to have to be crystal clear about the safety, the efficacy and what to expect with this vaccine as we go forward.
Dr. Brian Beattie, thank you very much for that from the College of GPs, the medical director there.
Some news just coming into us here at RNZ. The US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has told reporters votes remain to be counted in the election of the president and transition will be smooth no matter who is in the White House. Then he went on to say this.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there'll be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly. The world should have every confidence that the transition necessary to make sure that the State Department is functional today, and successful with the president who's in office on January 20th, a minute afternoon, will also be successful. I went through a transition on the front, and I've been on the other side of this. I'm very confident that we will do all the things that are necessary to make sure that the government, the United States government, will continue to perform its national security function as we go forward.
Our correspondent Simon Marks is with us from Washington. Simon, what to make of this?
Well, I mean, just on the facts, Susie, where he says everybody can be confident that the transition is going to be smooth. Under normal circumstances, with President-elect Joe Biden spending the morning today taking phone calls from foreign leaders, including Justin Trudeau of Canada, Boris Johnson of the UK, Emmanuel Macron of France, by now, Mike Pompeo and the State Department team are supposed to be in contact with the Biden camp, arranging that transition. And there is no contact underway between Mike Pompeo's State Department and the Biden campaign. No government department here appears to be engaged in any kind of transition. And those comments, with a smile on his face at the end there, that this is going to be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration, is only going to serve to underscore the anxieties that exist here, that Donald Trump is not just resisting conceding this election, resisting the point where he's got to pick up the phone and congratulate Joe Biden on his election win, but is now actively trying to undo and subvert the outcome of this American presidential election. In courts, in the court of public opinion, he's preparing to hold rallies of his supporters in a bid to mobilize their anger about the election's outcome. And he's seeking every single day to continue delegitimizing Joe Biden, the president-elect, in the eyes of the 71 million people who voted for Donald Trump. So this is yet another example of a Trump administration that, even if it is on the way out of the door, is absolutely intent on laying waste to America's constitutional normalcy, to the procedures that normally govern the transition between one government and another, and is still refusing to stipulate that it will engage in the peaceful transfer of power when the inauguration is due to take place on January the 20th.
But in a situation where an election was held and then a leader who was voted out of office refused to leave, wouldn't we normally call that a coup?
Yeah, you would absolutely normally call that a coup. And there are some voices here that are increasingly worried about what the Trump administration has in mind. The president yesterday defenestrated his defense secretary, the man who had refused to deploy troops on the streets of the United States to deal with protesters exercising their constitutional rights to demonstrate in the United States. There are fears that the FBI director and the head of the CIA could be next. And if you're Donald Trump, why on earth would you be shaking up the upper echelons of government if you truly thought that in 70 days everybody's packing their bags and leaving town? I mean, the signs here are worrying. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, is currently having lunch with Vice President Mike Pence. The vice president would not comment to reporters on his way into the building. Mitch McConnell sought to allay fears a little bit today that he himself had stoked yesterday. He insists normal procedures of vote certification will be followed. But that vote certification process, which is due to take place at the beginning of January will require Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill to certify that Joe Biden has won this election. And one wonders whether the Republicans will in fact be on board with that process by the time we get to January the 6th, which at the moment looks like it's a very long time away.
Thank you very much for that update. Simon Marks with us there from Washington. That's the breaking news that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has been speaking earlier on today. You heard a little bit of what he had to say there, saying there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.